You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today was supposed to be opening day for the Milwaukee Brewers. It is not, but we can still have some baseball fun. We'll look back at some of the greatest opening days in team history. First, we're in uncharted territory as state and federal governments work to figure out how to handle the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. Many governments, including here in Wisconsin, have issued guidance for people to remain home except for essential travel. But establishing best practices to ensure everyone's protection and to make sure some groups are not unfairly targeted still haven't been set in stone. This could leave some people, like immigrants, people of color, people in poverty, and more at a disadvantage. Our next guest joins us to talk about how outbreaks like this hit these vulnerable populations especially hard and what we and our governments can do to safeguard our neighbors in need. Emily Benfer is a visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and a health justice advocate. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. How are you?
Good. Well, you and a colleague recently, Emily, wrote about the coronavirus pandemic and how it affects different groups. Take us back to pre-pandemic and talk about some of the disparities there that are maybe put into relief by a crisis like this.
Well, for a long time, we've had disparities in health among low-income populations. There's approximately 38.1 million people who live in poverty. That's 11.8% of the population. And there is a direct connection between poverty and status as a marginalized group and poor health outcomes that we're seeing really increasing now. In fact, the lower a person's socioeconomic status, the more limited their resources and their ability to access essential goods and services. So this means they have a greater chance of chronic disease like heart disease or lung disease and other things that increase the mortality risk of COVID-19.
Then let's take it to some of the restrictions currently in place in many states of movement. What does that mean for someone from, say, a low-income group? What does that mean for them if they have this stay-at-home order, if it's harder to get around and get access to basic services, even like food, which we're generally allowed to go out and do?
Right. So this social distancing response it's really a challenge to try and mitigate the negative effects on poor and marginalized communities, because social distancing and sheltering in place, which are the key strategies, can be really challenging for people who are low income to do when they can't take time off of work, where they are living in crowded conditions, and where they don't have the ability to shelter in place.
And you write in this piece that for some people, very low income people, their housing itself might be a health threat. Being closed up in there might actually have an adverse health outcome. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. This epidemic, it really reinforces the critical role that housing plays in either hurting or protecting our health and safety and well-being. And most states, while they have a warranty of habitability standard, they often aren't enforced in low-income settings. So we're seeing conditions in housing that could pose great risk to people who are in low-income settings, like poor air quality or mold, asbestos, lead paint, or infestations. There are 35 million, which is 40% of homes in metropolitan areas that have one or more safety hazards. And there's a greater prevalence in rental properties. So where we are asking low-income people to shelter in place may actually be very dangerous for their health and increase the rate of needing emergency department care or emergency response. In fact, of the people who are sheltering in place, 2 million live in homes without heat, hot water, electricity, or that have structural defects. And not all of those states have actually ordered a utility shutoff freeze. So we're seeing a real deficit in the ability to stay safe while complying with the public health response.
Emily Benfer is with us from Columbia Law School. She's a health justice advocate. She recently wrote a piece on how the coronavirus pandemic and the measures used to try to contain it may have an adverse effect, especially on people in low-income communities, other marginalized groups. Emily, a lot of people are turning to the online world to stay connected to friends and family, to their work, to stay sane a little bit. But as we know here in Wisconsin, there are a lot of differences in access there. Can you talk about how you see that playing out?
So many people across the country do not actually have access to the internet or to Wi-Fi services. Fortunately, Comcast recently announced that they will be providing free Wi-Fi and internet during the pandemic to try and increase the rate that people have connection and access and can work at home. PSC in Wisconsin is actually offering low or no cost broadband with a $24 million state grant. Prior to the freeze on utility shutoffs, there were 1,481 families and households in Wisconsin without electricity, though. So you can see that this disparity existed beforehand, and COVID-19 is really bringing to the forefront all of these unmet needs and this crisis across the country, and demonstrating that socially disadvantaged people are much more vulnerable to the effects of COVID-19 and to the fallout that will happen after we've recovered from this crisis as well.
I've focused questions so far on low-income people. Who are some of the other groups that you might see being especially vulnerable during this time?
So really, it's anyone with a lower socioeconomic status. Also, people who have a greater chance of chronic disease, who have a higher increase of mortality risk related to COVID-19, and people who have less control over their environment and few alternatives to substandard housing. It's also exacerbated for people of color who are subjected to the consequences of discrimination and segregation in housing. So we're seeing this across every group that's traditionally been marginalized. And these are the same groups that have historically borne the brunt of infectious disease epidemics and the government responses to them. And we think that with a proactive approach that's really rooted in a commitment to health justice, that we could ensure that things are finally different with COVID-19. But it also extends to immigration, to people who are in prison, where they cannot safely quarantine or shelter in place, and they will risk the effects of this long into the future.
Emily Benfer is with us, visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and health justice advocate. She's with us to talk about how vulnerable populations will be impacted the most by the ongoing coronavirus outbreak and the measures that are out there to deal with it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Are you in one of these groups that doesn't have access to safe and healthy housing? Do you live worried that your utilities might be cut off, or you might be evicted? Do you not have access to broadband that might otherwise let you stay connected to friends, family, and work? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about the coronavirus pandemic and the impact it could have on communities that already faced health risks because of poverty or other factors. Emily Benfer is with us, visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and health justice advocate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are there steps you'd like to see at the local, state, or federal level to help protect vulnerable groups? What questions do you have about this issue? How are you being affected that other people might not think about? If you are in a low-income community, does stay-at-home mean something different for you than it might for someone else? Is work from home not a possibility for you? If you rely on certain medications, medical treatments, is it harder to get access to them right now? Call 800-642-1234. Emily, we've just hit a few of the problems you raised in your piece, but I want to get to some of the solutions you and your colleague offer. What for you would be some priorities you'd like to see from federal and state governments?
So I'm so glad you asked. One thing that I'd really love to focus on, especially in Wisconsin, is the moratorium on eviction. So across the country, we've seen a number of state courts order that state courthouses across that area not take any eviction filings throughout the pandemic, that there is ultimately a freeze on eviction filings throughout these states. And right now, there are 30 states who have suspended those cases. Wisconsin is not one of them. And there are only 15 states that have banned enforcement of past orders of eviction. And Wisconsin is also not one of those. In fact, Wisconsin has left suspension of eviction to local discretion. And there are a number of county circuit courts where evictions are continuing in the state of Wisconsin. And so this is an area of great urgency that we know that eviction, halting eviction, can actually flatten the curve, that it can reduce the rate of infection for COVID-19, and that keeping people housed safely and not being evicted and facing that downward spiral to a worse condition and a more unstable environment can help us maintain the public health. So this is an area that is very urgent and must go through as quickly as possible. Another is nutritional supports. For a lot of people who are low income, food stamps or SNAP and women, infant, and children funding is really the only income they have to help alleviate hunger in their family. The emergency declarations have freed up a number of resources to create regulatory flexibility that allows states and local leaders to fight insecurity during this crisis. And one of those is a pandemic EBT for children who would have received free meals at school. And states get to opt into that. Wisconsin is yet to do so. So this is another area of urgent advocacy and adoption of the state, where the state can actually intervene and protect low-income populations and make sure that they have enough food and other necessities to safely shelter in place to help protect the public health.
In national politics, all eyes are on this bill that came through the Senate. Looking at the U.S. House, this emergency relief bill, stimulus bill, people are calling it different things. Do you see things in there that are going to meet some of the concerns that you're watching for?
Yes. So this 880-page bill, it provides nearly $2 trillion in financial relief as we continue to grapple with the COVID-19 crisis. It's a start. It's a step in the right direction. There is a number of emergency appropriations related to unemployment and the 34 million workers who have no paid sick leave. And it's adding more to that. Moody Analytics estimated that 80 million jobs face some level of risk because of COVID-19, and 27 million are at high risk. So this package, the Corona Relief Package, is designed to address that and get funding into the pockets of Americans as quickly as possible so there's not as much disruption as there would be otherwise. Another positive aspect, there's $12 billion to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development for housing interventions. HUD has not given much guidance to public housing authorities across the country other than remote working. And so this is leaving a big gap in our housing policy. Historically, major housing policy reforms have grown out of health crises. And, you know, for example, in the 19th century, after two cholera outbreaks and concerns about high rates of contagion, we had a major housing infusion. And in the 1930s, it was the justification for public housing programs. So it is our hope that this pandemic will surface the need and urgency to really provide for safe and affordable housing across the country.
Emily Benfer is with us from Columbia Law School. We're looking at health disparities in the United States and how they're really being highlighted by the coronavirus pandemic and the response to it. Emily, that said, we're dealing with a crisis. We're kind of winging it here, trying to come up with solutions. Do you want to see more fundamental changes, even when we're not in the midst of a big crisis like this?
Absolutely. I think probably the only positive thing about COVID-19, if you could even call it positive, is that it really underscored all of the gaps in our systems, and it demonstrated for us where the safety net is unraveling, and we have to address the underlying reasons for that and to try and infuse our communities with the support that they need. And that's everything from unbiased and neutral responses, but also making sure that poverty does not carry a sentence of death and illness, especially in a pandemic. We have to redress these historical wrongs that are associated with longstanding patterns of structural inequality. And that is ultimately what achieving health justice is about. And if we can do that during this time and really support the communities that need it the most and that are at the highest risk of harm during this time, especially discriminatory enforcement and other issues, we can fare much better as a country and a society. That what's affecting low-income populations right now is affecting all of us.
We've mostly focused on things that could happen at the government level, state, federal, local, a little bit. Are there things that individual community members could be doing to look out for people, to help people out in this time where they might be being hit harder by the coronavirus epidemic?
Well, I think first and foremost, and we're hearing this everywhere, the most important thing people can do is abide by the social distancing guidelines. So sheltering in place, staying 6 feet away from each other, washing your hands constantly, and being very diligent about doing that in order to try and prevent further contagion, especially clustering. New York skyrocketed in a matter of days, and that could happen anywhere if we don't abide by those rules. And in terms of community level, I think everyone has an opportunity to contribute something here, whether it's their talents and engaging and connecting with each other, whether it's volunteering at the food pantries that really need a lot of support right now. If you stocked up on too much hand sanitizer, giving that to your neighbors, but also I think advocating. On the local community level, the mayor and the sheriff's office have a lot of control over eviction and over nutritional supports and utility freezes and how that's happening on a local level. So really advocating with your local government to make sure that everyone is being protected during this time, and recognizing that if we aren't protecting everyone and giving everyone access to the necessities they need in order to comply with these recommendations, that we are ultimately all going to be injured by that if we can't move forward.
Emily, we'll keep watching to see how this develops. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm very optimistic that we will be able to recognize how COVID-19 really underscores the importance of ensuring that all members of society benefit from and comply with these health measures. I hope everyone out there stays safe and healthy.
That's Emily Benfer, visiting associate clinical professor of law at Columbia Law School and a health justice advocate. She joined us today to talk about how we can protect our most vulnerable populations during the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. Coronavirus has changed life a lot in Wisconsin, but the state still has an April 7th election coming up with a presidential primary, state Supreme Court race, and hundreds of local races, too. For many people, those things aren't front and center in their minds right now. Rob Mentzer has more.
This is an emotionally intense time, so we asked people, how are you holding up?
I'm scared. I am concerned.
Melissa Markgraf lives in Langlade County. At a park in Green Bay, Bobby Joe Scholes didn't feel the same.
I don't know. There's not that much of a fear.
At a truck stop in Sparta, Josh Brown, Orlando Thomas, and Ann Sprain shared their feelings.
I'm a truck driver, so I deal with a lot of flu bugs, so it don't bother me none.
I guess I'm coping good. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's like an epidemic.
I am a little bit nervous, you know, concerned about health.
And in Wausau, Francis Slazak summed up the way a lot of people feel.
It's been a real roller coaster.
No one is feeling only one thing right now. It's a lot of different things all at once. Most people weren't really in the mood to talk about politics, but we know that the effects of all this on Wisconsin's economy, on 2020 elections, on people's lives, are going to be massive. Last week, the owners of the Wausau area restaurant where Slazak worked as a server called everyone in and told them they were laid off and they weren't sure when they'd reopen.
The meeting was very somber. There was fear. There was people not knowing what to do.
Slazak has a 6-month-old baby at home, and she's one semester away from finishing her degree in elementary education. Her partner is a respiratory therapist. She says they'll be okay financially, but she's still reeling.
My education is on hold, and my job is on hold. My life is a little bit on hold.
Markgraf and her husband own the Shady Brook Campground in Elko. They feel certain that they won't be able to open on April 15th like they usually do. But after that, they don't know.
I was talking to my husband about it just yesterday, and he said, Melissa, this is one we don't have to worry about for 30 days. And I said, okay.
She has a 5 and an 8-year-old at home. She's working from home for a food distributor and doing her best to provide stability. But it's hard.
Well, my anxiety, I wake up with my heart in my throat. And when I wake up and when the kids go to bed are the two most terrifying moments for me because it's quiet.
We also asked people around the state what they thought about the government's response to the crisis. the way people view what the government is doing right now could shape the way they vote in the future. Here's what Slezak, Brown, and Thomas had to say.
I think the government response on this crisis has been a little bit confusing.
They've made it political, which is not something any of them should be doing.
I think that they should have did this a while ago, like way before it got too serious.
And these were the views of Chris McDonough of Sun Prairie, Sandy Brewer of Madison, and Jerry Lease of Sparta.
Well, I think on the national level, it's a complete disgrace.
I think we're too slow. Too slow.
He's doing a pretty good job. He likes to talk. He gets a little ahead of himself. He ought to let the experts talk a little more.
The coronavirus has led to a surge in requests for absentee ballots for April elections. Democrats have called for extending the availability of absentee voting. The mayor of Green Bay said Wisconsin should switch to vote by mail for all elections. But all of that would take an act of the legislature, which has postponed its session. Brewer was a cashier at Target, and she works at the Hy-Vee grocery store in Madison. She's taken a leave of absence from both jobs. She says she's going to hibernate.
I'm 73 years old, and I have asthma. And if the coronavirus hits me, I'm at a very, very high risk of not making it.
Brewer is a political independent. She says she'll vote absentee on April 7th, and that she'll definitely vote in November, but she hasn't decided for whom. She says the U.S. government's response to coronavirus was too slow, and like all of us, she wonders what life will be like on the other side of all this. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up, the Milwaukee Brewers were supposed to open the 2020 season against the Cubs at Miller Park today. Since we can't really talk about that, let's hear about your favorite opening day memories. Do they involve tailgating or listening to or watching the game with friends and family? How many opening day games have you attended? Are you disappointed you can't be at Miller Park today? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll get it going after the news. Again, let us know your favorite opening day memory or what you're missing by not being at the game or watching or listening to it today. Let us know. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. We'll have that conversation coming up. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump says he wants the country to begin resuming normal operations on Easter, but his health experts on the coronavirus task force say that's probably too soon. We'll look at the debate over what to prioritize, public health or the economy. Now, if it weren't for the COVID-19 outbreak, we very well might be previewing the Milwaukee Brewers season right now. They made a lot of moves over the winter, opting not to re-sign some of their key players from the last couple of years, but they did lock up All-Star outfielder and 2018 National League MVP Christian Yelich to a long-term deal. They were supposed to open the season against the Chicago Cubs at Miller Park this afternoon, but now it's anyone's guess when that's going to happen. But we thought we'd celebrate opening day anyway by looking back at some of the greatest season openers in Brewers history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have an opening day tradition? Do you usually show up at the stadium for the home opener, or do you make plans to watch or listen to it on opening day? Are you bummed that it's not happening today? And do you have a favorite memory to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tom Hodricourt is a longtime Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, good to have you back with us.
Good afternoon. It's a weird feeling for me. I'm sure for a lot of your listeners too. As you said, we're used to seeing baseball, or at least listening to baseball on this day, aren't we?
Yeah, well, now it's your job, of course, and I assume you're bummed not to be doing it. But on a personal level, what's it like for you to have opening day canceled?
Well, it got real today, that's for sure. I mean, we've known that the season was going to be delayed because of the coronavirus. But, it gets real once the calendar turns to March 26th today, the day we knew the Brewers, as you said, the Brewers were going to play the Cubs at Miller Park today. So it starts getting real now. And, you know, we sort of know just from what they've said that the hiatus is going to go at least until mid-May. And, then, you know, that's 6 weeks or more from now. I got a feeling it's going to be a long 6 weeks, if not more.
What are Brewers and other teams doing nowadays?
Well, right now they're not doing much. I think at some point, if they reopen the workout facilities, I think guys will go back to working out in Arizona and here in Milwaukee as well. You know, at some point, if they are going to play games this year, they're going to have to resume training again at some point because they were not quite ready to play when they shut down. And now that they are being idle for so long, they're certainly going to need some type of workouts and exhibition games before they start playing regular games. So there's so many questions we have. There's no answers right now. It all depends how long the shutdown goes into the summer. You know, the longer they don't do anything, the more practice they'll need to get ready if they do start playing games again, or hopefully when they do start playing games again. I don't think any of us want to think of an entire summer without baseball.
Now, I know we won't have to go completely without. Fox Sports Wisconsin is going to rebroadcast, I think, last year's opener in just a bit. But you wrote a piece today, Tom, and you said your most memorable opening day in Brewers history came on 1880 at County Stadium with a big grand slam in the bottom of the ninth. Can you talk us through that moment?
In 1980, you know, that was a very strange beginning to the season. The Brewers' new manager, George Bamberger, he had only been on the job a couple of years, had a heart attack in spring training and had bypass surgery. And so he was sidelined, and they went with one of their coaches, Buck Rogers, as the manager. And so before the Brewers played that game, the opener, they played a message from George Bamberger on the video board at County Stadium, and he told everybody that he'd be back as soon as he could and go out and have fun and have a beer on me, as if he would have to encourage Brewers fans to have a beer on opening day. So I think a lot of people took him up on that, and, you know, it was a kind of a back-and-forth game. The Brewers were playing the Red Sox, and they had a two-run lead going to the ninth inning. And Carl Yastrzemski and Butch Hobson hit home runs off Jim Slayton, who was going for a complete game. And so now all of a sudden it's a tie game. And they go to the bottom of the ninth, and the Brewers load the bases, and Sixto Lescano, it's a grand slam. Of all things, a grand slam to win the game in the bottom of the ninth. And, you know, 50,000 people go nuts. And so what a way to start the season. Lescano had hit a grand slam on opening day 2 years earlier, and thus became the first major league player in history to hit grand slams in two opening days. And
wow.
Just a very dramatic way to win a game. And, you know, that was back, you know, the Brewers had just turned the corner and started being good after a pretty fruitful first decade as a team in the 70s. And oddly enough, that December, Lescano would be included in that huge trade with the Cardinals, in which they got Pete Vukovich, Ted Simmons, and Raleigh Fingers. And that's the trade that finally allowed them to make a postseason in 81 and go to the World Series in 82.
Talking to Tom Hodgecourt, longtime Brewers beat reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're remembering some great opening day moments, given that today's opening day isn't happening. Tom, that one was 1980. Last year's game opening day was a thriller. You included it in your piece about your most memorable opening days. Take us back to that one.
Yeah, that one ended with a great defensive play, not a great offensive play. The best offensive play in baseball is the grand slam home run. The best defensive play is stealing a home run. And the Brewers were ahead one run in the ninth inning last year. A pretty good seesaw game. And with two outs in the ninth inning, they were playing the Cardinals. Jose Martinez, a pinch hitter, sent a drive to deep right center that sure looked like a home run off the bat. But the Brewers' great center fielder, Lorenzo Cain, ran over, jumped, and caught the ball, reached up above the top of the fence and caught the ball and snatched away a home run. And, I mean, it's hard to imagine a defensive play, you know, being as thrilling as a grand slam. But in a way it was, because stealing a home run, especially, you know, I've been covering the Brewers since 1985. I've never seen an opening day end with someone stealing a home run before. And that was quite an electric way to win the game, too. So, yeah, it kind of covers both ends of the spectrum, a great offensive play, a great defensive play.
We heard from PJ on the Ideas Network Facebook page. PJ writes, "My friends and I showed up just to tailgate about 15 years ago. Some guys who obviously had a few too many came by our grill and said they'd trade us tickets for some drinks. Since we were underage, all we had was Canada Dry ginger ale. They said, we'll take it. So we got in the game for a few cans of soda just in time to see Russell Branyan hit a homer off the scoreboard." That's a great story. They didn't even expect to see the game in person. I love it. You know, that the tradition, Tom.
And for ginger ale, too. Yeah. Not beer, ginger ale. What a story that is.
Now, Tom, do you get to have fun before a game? I assume, you know, it's your job, so you don't get to go out there and you know, just tailgate and chill before a game. Do you get to have some fun with that kind of tradition?
Well, we always try to have fun at the ballpark, and right now we're covering baseball for a living. But, you know, opening day is a whole different animal. You know, there's a lot more media there. You know, there's a lot more pregame buzz. There's a lot going on. Mark Athanasio, the owner, usually holds a press conference. It's a very busy day. And so much emphasis is put on one game. You know, they play 162. And so, you know, sometimes people feel like, oh, my goodness, if you lose that game, the season's over already. Well, they got 161 games left afterwards. So you try not to put too much importance on it. But you know what? I think here in Wisconsin, we look at it more as than just a game. We sort of say, all right, spring's maybe finally going to come. You know, the boys of summer are out here playing a baseball game. I think we look at it as a seasonal change, and that summer's not too far away. And you know, like, suppose they would have played today. It's not the greatest day, but inside the ballpark with the roof. You know, that roof changed everything for us, because I write about a game, I believe, in 1997 when the wind chill was zero at the start of the game. And you know, when you can't feel your fingers, it's hard to hold the bat, you know. And so everything changed for us when Miller Park opened in 2001, and we got the, you know, people can talk all they want to about being hardy and, you know, taking your shirts off like they do at Packers games and stuff like that. But baseball is meant to be played in creature comfort, and the pitchers want to be able to feel the ball in their hands, and the hitters want to be able to feel the bat in their hands. It's not meant to be played in 0 degree wind chill.
Well, Tom, briefly as we wrap up, assuming we have a season that starts at some point in the near future, good prospects for the Brewers this year?
Well, they got Christian Yelich. You know, it all starts there. Boy, you know, he's in just 2 years with the team, he's won one MVP award and finished runner-up the other year. He's won batting titles both years. This guy is already arguably put together the two back-to-back greatest seasons in Brewers history. So if you got him, you've always got a chance to win. But I think, you know, they felt really good about their team going into camp, and it's a veteran team. They changed a lot of faces from last year, but they're all experienced players. They're not kids. And they still have a pretty good core of players. And I think they'll take their chances with anybody. You know, they've been to the playoffs two straight years for the first time since 81 and 82. So I think they had a lot of momentum coming into this season. And they'll be as anxious as anybody to get out there whenever they're able to start this season.
Well, fingers crossed, Tom. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. And, you know, let's hope that we can talk again on a real opening day, not one that got delayed.
All right. Tom Hodgecourt is the Brewers beat. We talked to them about some great opening day moments in Milwaukee Brewers history. Today was scheduled to be the home opener against the Chicago Cubs. Coming up, social distancing and stay-at-home mandates aim to slow the spread of the novel coronavirus, but they bring serious economic consequences along the way. We'll look at the challenges of balancing public health with our economic well-being. That's up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent talks to Wisconsin State Epidemiologist for Infectious Diseases about the latest efforts to slow the spread of COVID-19. It's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, nearly 65,000 people in America have tested positive for COVID-19. More than 1,100 have died. Two leading epidemiologists say it may be 3 to 6 weeks before the new coronavirus reaches its peak in the U.S. By the end of this week, people in 21 states, including here in Wisconsin, will be under some kind of statewide stay-at-home order. That comes out to more than half the U.S. population. There are other various restrictive measures in some other states as well. But those protections are hitting the economy hard. Today, the U.S. Labor Department said more than 3 million Americans filed for unemployment last week, shattering the previous record from 1982. The Dow Jones, while it's gone up in the last couple few days, it's off more than 7,000 points from its record high of 29,000 just 6 weeks ago. Earlier this week, President Trump says he wants to start reopening portions of society in a couple of weeks.
I said earlier today that I hope we can do this by Easter. I think that would be a great thing for our country, and we're all working very hard to make that a reality. We'll be meeting with a lot of people to see if it can be done. Easter is a very special day for many reasons. For me, for a lot of our friends, that's a very special day. And what a great timeline this would be.
But many health experts say reopening that soon could be especially dangerous. Susan Matthews is the news director at Slate. She recently wrote about how long we might be able to maintain the status quo and how we measure the impact and balance the impact of our anti-coronavirus measures. Susan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the title of your piece, the headline was, "Are We Doing the Right Thing?" And the difficult thing about answering that question is it's kind of hard to tell with this new situation right what the right thing is.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, we're kind of all participating in this mass experiment right now where I don't know a person whose life isn't pretty dramatically impacted by what we're trying to do right now. And we're in this really weird time, too, where we're trying to do something proactive. Well, a little reactive right now, actually, but we're trying to, you know, stay home, stay in place to prevent worse outcomes down the line. But it's really hard to do that when you're also watching your family members and your friends get laid off. And it just feels like we're in the middle of a couple of really hard choices.
Right. And there are two extremes you point out. One solution, and some people have talked about this, is kind of the what some people call the let it rip version. We just go back to normal, let the disease run its course. That's not something you're calling for in this piece, if I'm reading it right.
I do not think that's the right choice. But actually, it's interesting. I started thinking about writing this piece last week when President Trump was saying that it might be possible that we all shelter in place for about 18 months. And one thing that I think is really hard about this moment is that, you know, things are changing and what people are saying we ought to do is changing pretty rapidly, even from that position last week to the new position this weekend. And I think that right now, everyone really wants an answer, like, how long do I have to do this for? How long is this going to last? And I think that a lot of the problem here is that that really depends on how well we do right now and what happens next. So I think it's most helpful to really think about things in like discrete chunks of time, even though that's really hard. It's so much easier to think about, we're going to get through these 2 weeks and see what happens after that, see where we are then before we can really start to make the bigger picture planning.
Right. But as you were hinting there, and as you wrote in your piece, we're not going to shelter in place forever. At some point, coronavirus probably isn't going to completely go away, but we can't shut everything down forever. And what I read you as doing in this piece is really saying we need to start thinking about what possible futures might look like as we emerge and as the disease gets maybe hopefully more under control. What is the right middle ground? How do we start to sort that?
Right. Exactly. I mean, that's kind of the hard question right now, is that all public health officials are basically telling us for the next at least 2 to 3 weeks, we have to stay in place. But I think everyone also recognizes that it's not realistic that we're going to hide from this forever. So I think that there's kind of this middle ground of what's going to start happening once the initial epidemic kind of passes, where what we have to do is kind of try really hard to get a lot better at what we didn't do the first time. And what we didn't do the first time was really handle containment well. So we didn't have enough tests to know who was affected by this and who should self-isolate. That's kind of why we're in this position right now where everyone has to self-isolate. And if we try to get what we need to do is we need to get a lot more data, we need to get a lot more testing, and we need to try to figure out how are we going to reopen parts of the world and parts of the economy and parts of people's jobs, schools, so that people can go back to work, but they can also feel like they're safe.
Susan Matthews is with us, news director at the website Slate, talking about a piece she wrote about figuring out what our future is going to be as at some point we start to get away from stay-at-home orders and still deal with what will hopefully be the diminishing impacts of coronavirus in hopefully the not-too-distant future. We heard from President Trump a little while ago there. I want to give a listen to Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden talking on CNN about the president's goal of reopening America by Easter.
He should stop talking and start to listen to the medical experts. You talk about having an economic crisis. You want an economic crisis, watch this spike. Watch the number of dead go up. Watch the number of people who, in fact, connect with this virus. When are you going to be able to open the economy? Look, we all want the economy to open as rapidly as possible. The way to do that is let's take care of the medical side of this immediately.
That's something we've also heard from some leading Republicans. Representative Liz Cheney, one of the top Republicans in the U.S. House, saying, yes, the shutdown hurts the economy, but yes, the unfettered spread of this illness could also hurt the economy. There's a lot to sort out here, Susan.
Yeah, it's kind of at this point a false choice to kind of try to say that, either we're going to have this complete shutdown in the disease or we could just open the economy back up. The disease is here. We can't open the economy back up without facing some pretty severe ramifications from that. And I think that that's one of the things that I was really thinking about and trying to get at when I was writing this is everyone is kind of dealing with their own experience of sheltering in place right now. A lot of us are alone. We're with our families. We're by ourselves. We're trying to get information, but it's really hard to know like what exactly is going on out there. And there's the tendency to just think like, we really need to open this up. But the reality is right now is that even if we open things back up, the disease is still going to be there. The overwhelmed hospitals are still going to be there. And that's going to have its own really significant impacts on the economy. So the option of let's just start it back up again isn't really there. I would really like there to be an option for everything to just go back to normal. I think that's what everyone really wants, but that's just not the possibility right now. And so what we really have to think about is what do we do right now to maximize our chances of lowering the spread, to stay home to do that, and then to eventually get to the point where we can start to make a much more strategic plan at starting up. And that's what you've seen has happened and has worked in the other countries that have had a much better experience with this coronavirus. South Korea specifically is one that I'm thinking of, where they had much wider spread testing early on, much better containment early on, and that kind of allowed them to be in a different position than the position that we're in now.
Briefly, as we wrap up, what are some lessons you hope we learn from this for maybe the next illness that spreads around the world?
Well, I think that testing is so important. The importance of data is so important. And listening to our public health officials, I mean, the real thing here is that if we had maybe been better prepared, we could have gotten a better handle on this sooner. And that is something that I hope that we remember for next time.
Susan, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Susan Matthews, news director at Slate. We talked to her today about the challenges of balancing public health and the economy amid the COVID-19 outbreak and the need for more data about what's happening, how widespread it is. By the way, you can stay up to date on the coronavirus in Wisconsin at WPR.org/coronavirus. And you can ask your questions and our news team or we on the talk side of things can try to tackle them. You can ask questions about coronavirus or anything in Wisconsin over at the Wisconsin webpage. You can find that via WPR.org. Look for Wisconsin. That's like W-H-Y-Sconsin. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the defense production budget is a way for the federal government to boost production of masks, ventilators, and other key medical supplies. We'll find out what it is and how it could work during the current pandemic. An expert on leadership in tough times shares some lessons from great leaders of the past for the challenges facing the nation today. and it's in the beans. On this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest puts the humble bean front and center for some nutritious and delicious cooking. If that's one of the things you've stocked up on or overstocked up on, you won't want to miss this. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, get ready for a Wisconsin weekend with some great music suggestions to get you through a time of physical distancing. Kate and her guests round up some great tunes, and you can share the music you've been discovering or maybe rediscovering lately. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, have you been dusting off some video games you used to play? A lot of people are getting into or getting back into gaming these days. We'll dig into the world of video games, and you can tell us what you're playing and get us started right now over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.